My audiobooks.ai presents The Overshoot Doctrine. The UN just changed the story of climate change. On September 2nd, 2026, the United Nations Environment Program published a report with an unremarkable cover and a remarkable admission. The report is called Limiting Overshoot, and its central sentence is the kind that historians of the climate era will quote. Under current policies and alternative near-term trajectories, exceedance of 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming is now widely assessed as unavoidable. Not probable. Not possible. Unavoidable. The institution that spent a decade telling the world to keep 1.5 alive has now formally, in print, told the world that we will cross it, most likely within the next few years. To understand what just happened, you have to understand what that number was. 1.5 degrees was never a scientific constant, like the boiling point of water. It was a political-physical hybrid, negotiated into the Paris Agreement in 2015 as the line beyond which the risks of climate change were judged to become unmanageable, the line below which coral reefs might mostly survive, ice sheets might remain stable, and low-lying nations might keep their coastlines. For 10 years, it functioned as the climate movement's organizing principle, its unit of urgency, its scoreboard. Every summit, every pledge, every protest chant referenced it. Keep 1.5 alive. The phrase itself was borrowed from the nations with the most to lose, the small island states, whose delegates fought to write 1.5 into the Paris text because 2 degrees, for them, was not a worse outcome. It was an absence of outcome, the literal disappearance of the land their treaties were signed on. The bigger economies accepted the number partly as conscience and partly as aspiration, and for a decade, the hybrid held, a target strict enough to matter, vague enough to sign. And now, the referee has walked to the center of the field and announced that the goal everyone was defending has already been scored, and that the game, rather than ending, will continue under new rules.
The new rules have a name: overshoot, peak, and decline. The UNEP report defines overshoot as a dynamic pathway, the exceedance of 1.5, a peak level of warming, and then, if the world does nearly everything right, a subsequent decline back below the threshold by century's end. This is not surrender dressed in jargon, the report insists, and it is worth reading its exact words, because the words are the doctrine. Overshoot is not an argument for resignation, but rather for urgency to action. Mitigation and adaptation must advance together. The evidence, it says, consistently indicates that higher peak warming and longer durations of exceedance are associated with greater risks for people and nature. The formula underneath the entire doctrine is therefore deceptively simple. How high the peak times how long the stay equals how bad the damage. Everything left to fight for lives inside those two variables. This article is about what it means that the world's climate institutions have changed tense, from the future we must prevent to the future we must now manage. The thesis is this: the overshoot doctrine is simultaneously the most honest thing the climate establishment has ever published and the most dangerous. Because the same sentence that finally tells the truth about the trajectory also hands every government on Earth a new excuse for delay. Which of those it becomes is a choice that has not been made yet. That choice is the story. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts, turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. First, the honesty, because it is overdue and it matters. The physics of the situation has been visible in the data for years. the World Meteorological Organization's State of the Climate report, published in March of 2026, confirmed that the 11 years from 2015 through 2025 were the hottest 11 years in the instrumental record, with 2025 itself running about 1.43 degrees above pre-industrial levels. A single year, essentially touching the threshold that was supposed to represent a multi-decade average we must never reach. The same report documented record ocean heat content, the highest measured planetary energy imbalance, continued glacier loss, and relentless sea level rise. Meanwhile, the UN's own Emissions Gap report had already shown that even if every national climate pledge were fulfilled, the world was on track for roughly 2.3 to 2.5 degrees of warming, and under the policies actually in force, closer to 2.8. Against those numbers, continuing to chant keep 1.5 alive had stopped being a target and started being an incantation. Words spoken for the comfort of the speaker rather than the guidance of the listener. So the UNEP did something institutions almost never do. It said the quiet part. And it is important to be precise about what the quiet part is and is not. The report does not say the fight is over. It does not say 1.5 no longer matters. It says something subtler, and in a way more unsettling, that the threshold will be crossed, that the crossing is now a planning assumption rather than a risk to be avoided, and that the meaningful question has shifted from whether we exceed it to how far past it we go and how long we stay there. The optimistic scenarios in the current literature cluster around a peak near 1.8 degrees before a return. The current policy trajectory points toward 2.6 by 2100. Between 1.8 and 2.6 lies the entire remaining arena of climate politics. Every summit, every vote, every pipeline decision, every election. Because the difference between those two numbers is measured in meters of sea level, in percentage points of species loss, in the habitability of regions where hundreds of millions of people live. One more piece of physics explains why the institution finally conceded, and it is the piece that does the most to confuse public debate: inertia. The climate system is not a light switch, but a loaded freighter. Oceans absorb most of the trapped heat and release it slowly, so the warming measured today is the result of emissions from years ago, and the warming locked in for the next decade or two is already aboard, invisible in the hold, regardless of what is done this year. This lag cuts both ways in the argument. It means some near-term crossing of 1.5 was genuinely unstoppable by the time the data confirmed it, which is the report's best defense of the word unavoidable. But it also means the converse. Action taken now does not pay off immediately, which is exactly why delay always feels cheap. The bill for today's choices arrives on a delayed schedule, addressed to people who did not make them. Alongside that lag sits the simpler arithmetic of the carbon budget. The atmosphere does not care about rates or dates. It cares about the cumulative total of carbon ever added. For a reasonable chance of holding 1.5, scientists estimated years ago that humanity had a finite remaining allowance of a few hundred billion tons of carbon dioxide. The world currently emits tens of billions of tons every year. Divide the allowance by the burn rate, and the conclusion the UNEP finally printed falls out of grade school arithmetic. At anything like current emissions, the budget for 1.5 runs out in a handful of years. The surprise in the report is not the conclusion. It is that the institution finally said the division out loud. Now for the machinery. Because the word return in the doctrine is doing enormous work and deserves scrutiny. How does a planet come back from overshoot? The physics of cooling is not the physics of warming run in reverse. Carbon dioxide persists in the atmosphere for centuries, So stopping emissions does not lower temperatures. It stops the rise. To actually bring the temperature back down, the world must do two things at once: drive emissions to zero, and then pull carbon out of the air at planetary scale. The second half of that sentence is called negative emissions, and it is the load-bearing assumption of every return pathway ever modeled. Reforestation, soil carbon, machines that scrub carbon dioxide from the sky, crops burned for energy with the carbon captured and buried. The scenarios differ in mix, but not in magnitude. The return pathways require removing billions of tons of carbon dioxide per year by mid-century. Current global capacity for engineered carbon removal is measured in millions of tons. The gap between those two numbers is not a gap. It is three orders of magnitude, and closing it is the single largest infrastructure project in human history, undertaken while also replacing the entire energy system. None of this is secret, and the UNEP report does not hide it. The doctrine's honesty extends to the scaling problem, but the structure of the promise matters for everything that follows. The return is conditional. It depends on technologies and land use changes that do not yet exist at scale, deployed by political systems that have so far moved at a fraction of the required speed, sustained for decades without interruption. The overshoot doctrine, read carefully, is a promissory note written against a future industrial mobilization. Whether that note will be honored is the central climate question of the next 30 years. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines. There is a second, harder problem inside the doctrine, and it lives in the word decline. Some things do not come back when the temperature does. Scientists call the relevant property irreversibility, changes that are effectively permanent on human timescales, that persist for centuries or forever, regardless of what the thermometer does afterward. The big ice sheets are the canonical case. Once Greenland's ice is destabilized past a certain point, its loss feeds on itself, and it will not regrow because the air cooled again. The sea level rise it delivers is permanent on any timescale a civilization plans in. Permafrost carbon, once thawed and released, joins the atmosphere and cannot be refrozen into the ground. Coral reef systems, most marine biologists expect, will be largely gone beyond 2 degrees of peak warming, and they will not unbleach when the models show a return. And extinction, of course, is the one climate impact with no reverse gear at all. Every overshoot pathway crosses thresholds of this kind. The only question is how many and how deep. The doctrine's own logic, higher peak, longer stay, greater risk, is precisely the logic of irreversible loss. A world that returns to 1.4 degrees after peaking at 1.9 is not the world that never exceeded 1.5. It is a different world, with different coastlines and different species, wearing the same temperature. This is why the danger half of the thesis cannot be waved away. The overshoot doctrine hands every actor who ever wanted an excuse a beautifully crafted one. Why cut emissions this decade if the target is already breached and the plan is to come back later? Why shut a coal plant this year when the official doctrine says the game now runs to 2100? Why endure any political pain at all when the United Nations itself has reclassified the emergency as a chronic condition to be managed? These arguments are coming if they are not already in talking points, and they will be made by people quoting the report's own title. The word for this is moral hazard, the tendency of a safety mechanism to produce the behavior it insures against. Seatbelts are good, and drivers with seatbelts take more risks. Both things are true at once. An insurance policy against climate failure, written by the institution that was supposed to prevent the failure, may ensure the failure into existence. Buried in the doctrine's second clause is its least discussed revolution, adaptation, elevated from an admission of defeat to a co-equal pillar of policy. For years, serious climate institutions treated talk of adapting to a hotter world as a dangerous distraction from preventing it. The overshoot framework reverses that hierarchy, in practice, if not in rhetoric. If the crossing is a planning assumption, then seawalls, heat action plans, shifted crop calendars, redesigned cities, and relocated infrastructure are not supplementary homework. They are half the assignment. This is a real intellectual migration, and it carries its own quiet controversy, because adaptation money spent well in Rotterdam looks very different from adaptation money needed in Dhaka, and the doctrine does not resolve who pays for the difference. The strongest case against this article's worry must be stated fairly, and it is built into the report itself. The document's authors clearly anticipated the misuse, because the text keeps repeating its counterspell. Not resignation. Urgency. Mitigation and adaptation together. Every increment of peak and duration costs more. The doctrine, read in full, is not permissive. It is triage. It says, the ambulance will not arrive in time to prevent the injury, so drive faster, not slower, and prepare the trauma ward. The moral hazard is not in the text. It is in the space between the text and the incentives of the people who will cite it. There is also a fair question about why the institution moved now, and the answer is not flattering to anyone, including the institution itself. For years, the credibility of the 1.5 target depended on nobody checking the arithmetic too carefully. Once the world's hottest 11 years on record sat in the same database as the pledges that were supposed to prevent them, the target's authority began to decay. A goal that is publicly impossible does not motivate, it discredits. The overshoot doctrine is, among other things, a credibility repair operation, an attempt to keep the climate framework useful by re-anchoring it to something physically true. The risk is that the repair trades one kind of failure for another, the failure of an impossible goal for the failure of an elastic one. Because an elastic goal can be stretched indefinitely by anyone who finds the stretching convenient. The Secretary General's own framing, delivered alongside the report, is worth a sentence of attention, because it reveals how the institution hopes the doctrine will be read. Antonio Guterres called the moment a fight for humanity, deliberately martial language, attached to a report whose entire structure is an admission that one battle in that fight has been lost. The pairing is the institution's wager in miniature, that conceding the breach will stiffen rather than sap the will to limit what comes after. History offers examples in both directions. There are retreats that rallied armies, and retreats that became routs. And which one this is will be decided by the same unglamorous machinery as everything else in this story. Permits, power plants, budgets, and ballots. What would prove this article's worry wrong? Three findings would disprove it, stated as concretely as the claim. First, if global emissions fall measurably faster in the next few years than the current policy trajectory assumes, if the peak arrives early and low, near 1.6 rather than 1.8, then the doctrine will have functioned as intended, as a spur, not a sedative. Second, if engineered carbon removal scales from millions to hundreds of millions of tons per year within the decade, on cost curves anything like solar powers, then the return pathway stops being a promissory note and becomes a plan. Third, if the first post-overshoot summits produce binding peak and duration limits, treaties written around how high and how long, with the same legal force Paris gave the threshold, then the elastic goal will have acquired a spine. Each of these is observable within years, not decades. It is worth naming, before the ending, what this article has not claimed. It has not claimed that 1.5 degrees was a magic line, with safety on one side and ruin on the other. Every increment of warming always mattered, and the threshold was always a negotiating instrument as much as a physical boundary. It is not claimed the UNEP is wrong to publish the truth. An institution that cannot say the unavoidable out loud eventually cannot say anything at all. It is not claimed that return is impossible, only that return is conditional, and the conditions are industrial and political, not merely technical. And it has not claimed the fight is over, because the doctrine itself says the opposite. The fight simply moved from a single line to the entire space above it. That reframing, honestly absorbed, is what makes the report momentous. For a decade, climate politics was a siege, one wall, one gate, one number to defend. The overshoot doctrine concedes the wall and redefines the war as a war of maneuver. Every tenth of a degree of peak, every year of duration, every ton removed from the sky. A war of maneuver has no single moment of defeat, which is precisely what makes it harder to lose and easier to lose slowly. The outcomes are no longer binary, saved or doomed. They are a continuous spectrum of worse, and the only thing that decides where on that spectrum our grandchildren live is everything done or not done in the next 10 years. The United Nations has told the world, in writing, that the line will be crossed. What it cannot tell the world is how far past the line we will go, because that is not the UN's decision. It belongs to the same place it always belonged, to grids and ballots, to budgets and boardrooms, to the unglamorous machinery of permits and power plants. The doctrine has changed. The physics has not. The peak is still being chosen, right now, in the present tense, the only tense the atmosphere has ever read. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.